This morning I wanted to talk some more about skillful means to assist the practice of meditation. In particular, that one reads in the Buddha's teachings again and again that the proximate cause for gaining samadhi, for gaining peaceful states of mind, is a happy mind, a mind which has joy in it. And it's a very good thing to keep in mind and to remember that if the mind is feeling tired, depressed, angry, upset, then it isn't really a sort of mind which can be worked and used to gain this peaceful, quiet state of mind. You'll find that you'll go wandering off or dreaming or just go asleep in your meditation. And in this practice of meditation, that we deliberately arouse a joy in the mind when we're meditating or when we're on a meditation retreat. And it's one of the reasons we try to have the meditation retreat in very peaceful and beautiful surroundings. Surroundings where one can use one's perception to deliberately arouse joy. Like many things in life, that joy is always there. It's just a matter of turning the perception to notice it, to allow oneself to dwell on the sound of the birds outside, or just on the feeling of the wind on one's cheeks, or just the recognition that this weekend or this 9 days is an opportunity where you are free from all of your usual burdens and responsibilities. You have nothing to do, you have no worries. And just turning the mind to that which is positive in this situation, looking for happiness, looking for joy, you find that it's there. And you can start to delight in the beauty of the garden outside, or just to delight in the feeling of the wind, or delight in the sound of the birds. And what that does, it prepares the mind, it makes the mind feel happy, it gives it joy, it actually widens the mind and gives it energy. And that wide, energetic, happy mind, you'll find is much easier to work with. It's much easier to gain the results in meditation which you are seeking. It's one of the basic principles that the monks know so well, that you can always look for someone who's going to be a good meditator by the one who's light-hearted and can smile a lot. You know, the happy monks are usually the good meditators. The same as that, the happy lay people. You can look at them, and the happy ones, the ones who can smile, who can take life easily, the one who can look and find for joy in life, are the ones who usually have an easy time in gaining deep states of mind. And there is that very strong connection there between a happy mind and a mind which is easy to concentrate. And therefore, a very important prerequisite to your meditation should be developing this happiness and finding ways and means to develop happiness. Whether that's, you know, enjoying your breakfast, or whether it's enjoying the nature of this place, whether it's reflecting on the freedom that you have this 9 days, or using other methods to develop this happy state of mind. And one of those methods for developing the happy state of mind is doing loving kindness meditation, the meditation on metta, because that usually does bring up happiness and joy into the mind. And the metta meditation is where that you deliberately cultivate this feeling of warmth towards all beings. Many of you would know that meditation well enough. I wanted to extend that type of meditation in an interesting area which you might like to experiment with. It's an area where I found very useful It's developing loving-kindness meditation, metta, towards your breathing. The feeling of loving-kindness is that which embraces, accepts, feels warmth, and feels gratitude towards. And so if we're developing loving-kindness towards the breathing, then at every in-breath and every out-breath, you cultivate the same sort of attitude, reflecting that this breath has been like serving you for all your life. It's been keeping you alive, it's been nourishing you. And very often, that which happens all the time, we take for granted. We never say thank you. We just allow the breath to go in and go out without ever really considering it. And developing this feeling of loving kindness towards your in and out breath is a way of watching this breath with warmth, with gratitude, with a very soft and caring energy. You can either look upon your breath as you would look upon your parents, someone who has nourished you, supported you, and kept you going. Or you can look upon it as your child, something which, because it has nurtured you, now you can nurture it. And if you look upon the breath with that sort of attitude, with the attitude of love, with kindness, with warmth, you'll find it's easier to watch. It's easier to keep track of. Because that which you don't take for granted, that which you care about, that which you're concerned about, makes a deeper mark in one's perception. Also, the meditation on loving kindness will always be a joyful meditation once it starts going, and so it also brings joy in to the mind around the breath. So when I do that, this type of meditation, I'm not just watching the breath, I'm watching the breath with metta, thanking the breath, caring for the breath, loving the breath for looking after me, as if it was a very good and close friend. And as I breathe in just with this feeling of warmth and embracing towards the feeling of the breath, from the beginning to its end. When the breath goes out, I watch it, observe it, with the same feeling of kindness and care and embracing. And I find not only is the breath more visible to my mind, but also it is more enjoyable to watch. If the object of the mind has a factor of joy within it, then the mind finds it easier to watch. If the object which you're trying to focus on is painful or disturbing, it's very difficult to watch. And if it's a sort of a neutral type of object, it's very easy for that object just to fade away in with dullness. However, if one can develop the perception that that object of mind is indeed attractive, joyful, beautiful, worthy of care, then it's very easy to observe and to watch. So this is one of the skillful means of developing loving kindness around the experience of breath, to enable the attention to be more easily applied onto the breath. The breath doesn't become something neutral, it becomes something attractive, something joyful and something beautiful. And hopefully you'll find that that becomes an easier thing to watch. Not only does it make it an easier object to watch, but it also starts to encourage like a state of mind which is very important in the later stages of meditation, which is the emotional state of mind. If one is going to take this meditation to its deeper levels, especially if one is going to enter into one of these jhana states, one has to be able to feel at ease with these powerful emotional states of mind. Because if one is going to describe something like a jhana, it is very much akin to an emotional state of mind, a state of great bliss and power, much closer to emotional states than to rational states of mind. And as such, that one can make some very powerful and effective preparations by developing, deliberately developing that emotional warmth and happiness which comes along with metta meditation. You're actually preparing the mind very well to accept the more profound emotions of the jhanas. And for this reason, that whether one is developing the metta meditation on the breath or just a general metta meditation, it becomes a very useful and skillful tool to incorporate into one's practice of meditation. Not only does it bring in up the easeful, happy state of mind, but it also brings up the emotional aspect of the mind which will prepare you for accepting the emotional states of the jhanas. You actually feel your way into the jhanas, you don't think your way in. So this is one of the very useful and skillful means which you can try during this meditation retreat, developing loving kindness towards the breath, as well as doing from now and again loving kindness meditations to brighten up the mind. However, there are many other skillful means which one can use to brighten up the mind and create joy within it. And these are part of the meditations which the Buddha taught. One or three of those meditations are the reflections on the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, which is one of the reasons why I wish to incorporate the chanting into this meditation retreat. Because those chants which we do are the reflections on the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, on the qualities. And if one has a feeling for what those three words mean, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, then reflecting on it, keeping the meaning of those words in the mind and sustaining your attention on those meanings long enough, will very often bring up great feelings of happiness and joy. It's a means of brightening the mind, of giving the mind that happiness, giving the mind that joy. And one uses that as a springboard. From there, one goes off to watch the breath. So this is another means of bringing joy into the mind. For those who are traditional Buddhists, this becomes a very effective way of beginning the meditation. It's quite common, I know, in Thailand for people to teach meditation in the way of beginning every time by paying homage to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha in your mind. And for a traditional Buddhist, just that paying homage in the mind to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, reflecting in the mind on those qualities, will bring up such happiness and joy and bring up a softness, a reverence in the mind. It will prepare the mind so that it can do the breath meditation afterwards. If you find that you are someone who has that ability to arouse faith or confidence in the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and if you find that it's easy to do and it brings up joy and happy states of mind, then I can encourage that during the meditation retreat. To begin the meditation just by reflecting on what the Buddha did, who he was, the kindness, the compassion, and all that word means to you. Oh, what a marvelous blessing it is in the world that there was such a being as the Buddha, and the great benefit which his life gave to all of us. And just by dwelling and cultivating those thoughts, it should start to bring like a softness into the heart, an emotional joy, which is the preparation of mind that I'm talking about. Or the Dhamma, the teachings which you have heard, that which has solved problems for you, that which has sounded so beautiful and delightful. If one develops a taste for something, one can develop a love for it. You see, I remember in my youth seeing people who would listen to a piece of music and they would cry. And if you can develop like the appreciation of the Dhamma, and you read a very profound teaching of the Buddha, or you hear it, again it can bring the tears of joy into your eyes, if you are of such a temperament. And if you are of such a temperament, just reflecting and remembering on some of the Buddha's teachings, some of your favorite pieces of Dhamma, will also bring up that feeling of softness and joy and happiness in the mind. And one uses this as the state, as the jumping off point for breath meditation. And if not the Buddha, not the Dhamma, then maybe the Sangha. Some of the monks or nuns you've met in the past who have inspired you, who you feel great respect towards, even those you may not have met but you've read about and you have an appreciation of, just developing the thought of those members of the Sangha, or developing the idea of the whole history-wide Sangha, should be able to bring you this happiness and this joy. Because I was a monk in Thailand for many years and visited many of the great teachers over there, it's very easy for me just to even visualize some of these great monks who I met personally, and to appreciate just what they gave to the world and what they're still giving to the world. And just imagining that and cultivating that thought and developing that thought, it just makes my mind just filled with gratitude and love and softness and joy that such beings exist in the world. And as such, it gives me the basis for developing happiness. And after that, I can develop the meditation on the breath. So if you are of such a mind, you may try developing the reflection on the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha in this way, to develop happiness and joy. The meditations or the reflections on the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha are not powerful enough to get you into a jhana. Their purpose is to overcome the more coarser obstacles to the development of deep states of stillness. And in particular, they develop this happy mind, this joyful mind, which, once established, one can take further by changing the object of meditation to something like the breath. One can take that further and go and enter a jhana. One of the other ways of developing happiness and joy in one's meditation is one which I use a lot, especially now in my role as like the senior monk at the monastery in Serpentine, and that's reflecting, bringing up, remembering on all the past service one has done and given. Sometimes in the West we are loath, or we're taught not to praise ourselves or to think too much on our goodness or what we've done for others. But in the teaching of the Buddha, one does not find that those words which discourage you from thinking such things. In fact, you are encouraged to reflect upon your past generosity, liberality, service, and to reflect upon it again and again and again. And if you do bring up all that you've done in for others, everything which is good and noble and caring all the good karma which you've done in the past day, the past week or past year, and dwell upon it, again it brings up happiness and joy. The reason why I use this meditation these days is because sometimes that you may be doing many external activities, going into town and running around all day doing this and that for others. And very often when I go back to the monastery after the weekend, I'm very, very tired, just physically worn out for doing so much. But the only way that I can meditate that evening is to just sit down and just think of all the good which I've done, all the service which I've done. This is not to make me proud, but this is to make me happy, to bring up energy and joy inside of me. And I'm not afraid of like crying at all of the service which I've done that day, because it makes me feel that way. It brings up the emotion of happiness and joy. And once you can get into this, you find that all of the service which one has given to others, all of the merit one has made during the day or during one's life, that one can unlock that source of energy and power and use it for meditation. And it becomes a very powerful source of energy, a very powerful source of joy. And having developed that happiness, developed that joy, once it's strong, then I can turn over to the breath, and the breath becomes very easy to watch. Not only is it very clear, but the mind has got energy, the mind has got happiness, and it's very easy to take that into a deep state of meditation. It's only because of these preliminary exercises of developing the reflection on one's past goodness, doing reflection on Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, or doing reflection on loving kindness. This is part of the training in meditation. To be able to do breath meditation, it doesn't just mean being able to watch the breath. It means knowing how to prepare to watch the breath, knowing how to do these preliminary exercises and when they're needed, and not being afraid of them. Because very often that people will not do the meditation on the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha because they're afraid of them, maybe because they've been conditioned against any faith mind by their experiences, maybe in Christianity or in other religions in the past. You know that you are in complete control of developing any faith. You can stop whenever you like, but it is a power in the mind which you can use to your advantage. It's not going to be used against you. And the power of those emotions are not dangerous. As long as faith is balanced by wisdom, in most Westerners, the wisdom is far stronger than any faith. As long as the faith and wisdom are balanced, then there's no danger there. It's only when the faith is so strong and wisdom is very weak there is any danger. But here, you can feel quite confident that there's nothing to fear through developing these sorts of faith minds. And these sorts of faith minds will develop that joy, that confidence, and will actually propel you into the deep meditation states. So these are ways of preparing the mind when you are doing the meditation on the breath. If at some times you find the mind is dull, it's got no energy, or it's restless, and you find it very difficult to follow the breath, then try one of these other meditations. Either the meditation on loving kindness, on Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, or the meditation on one's own past goodness. Or if that doesn't work, just go and develop joy by going sitting outside, walking outside, and developing that perception, that positive perception, that one has a healthy body, a reasonably healthy body. One has found the ability to come on a meditation retreat. one has already got enormous good karma, a lot of merit just to get this far. And that should bring up happiness and joy in to your mind. And if it does, then it's to be used for gaining deeper states of meditation. There was a story in the time of the Buddha where the Buddha's chief female disciple, Vaisakha, asked the Buddha if she could give, if she could have a special permission to give cloth for the reins to the monks and to the nuns, and also to feed any monks or nuns who arrive in that town, give them the first meal and also the last meal before they leave on any journeys, and if she could also give food to sick monks and nuns and those serving the sick. Because if there was a sick monk or nun, then those might need special food, and also those serving them, looking after them, the nurse monks and nurse nuns, maybe would not be able to find food for themselves, and so it would be help, a great help, if she could send food directly to them. And she asked the Buddha if she can be the one to do all of this. And the Buddha replied to her that I don't give such permission just to one person against any others. Why should I give it just to you? And this lay disciple Vaisakha replied, well, if you allow me to do this, then I know that any monk or nun who gains attainment in meditation, or gains any stage of enlightenment, or becomes fully enlightened in this monastery, in the Jeta Grove, and I know that I would have fed them at least once when they first arrived. Very likely I would have fed them when they left, or when they were sick or nursing the sick. I would have given them these reins, bathing cloths. When I reflect upon that, when I remember that, that I have helped and contributed to their attainments, she said, it will give me such happiness and joy that I'll be able to take that happiness and joy and develop samadhi. And developing samadhi myself, I'll be able to understand and see your teachings. And understanding and seeing your teachings, I'll become a noble disciple myself. And the Buddha was so impressed with her wisdom and understanding that he gave her permission to, he did afterwards and gave her permission to do these things. Because she understood that this is a means for developing joy, which is the means for developing samadhi. So, whatever goodness you have done during the day, during the weeks, during the years, bring that up, develop it, develop the thought about that. To dwell upon that good side of your life, the beautiful, the soft, the caring, the generous, the wonderful side. And that will bring up the happiness and joy, and then you'll find it very easy to develop the blissful meditation. Do not be afraid of that emotional self-respect. These are some of the skillful means which we can use for developing the meditation on the breath, to be used alongside the basic technique. So, has anyone got any questions or comments about these assisting techniques? Sadha, yes, the faith mind, the confidence mind. It's just that for many Westerners, that one can be afraid of the word faith, because it has been misused in many Western traditions and religions. Again, the reason why it's been misused is because it hasn't been balanced with wisdom. In the five powers which the Buddha taught, he always said that faith and wisdom should always be balanced. And if one is very strong and the other is very weak, you always find problems. Even if you have a lot of wisdom but very little faith, it's still not good enough. The wisdom is cold wisdom, and it's not powerful. But if you have too much faith and not much wisdom, you can get, again, into all sorts of troubles, believing in all sorts of ridiculous stuff. But if faith and wisdom are balanced, then it creates tremendous power. And to develop that faith, and it's not just faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, it's faith in yourself as well, becomes a very powerful help to the meditation. If your mind is cold and dry and there's no energy there and you're fed up, there's no way you get deep meditation. So bring up the joy, bring up the happiness. And if you really love Buddhism, the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha, dwell upon that until that becomes very strong. And then that can push you out, push you into deep states of mind. You know, as a Westerner, as a scientist, you know, it took me till 17, 18 years as a monk before I could bow to the Buddha and cry. And then you have tears running down my cheeks, you know, out of gratitude and out of faith. And sometimes that was coming up, but I was afraid of it. But now you realize not only does it feel very good, but it also, if I can do that, then when I sit, it's very easy to sit very long and very deeply. So if you can do that and develop that, you find you are assisting the meditation enormously. So meditation is not just sitting on the cushion hour after hour hoping that something will happen. You've got to be a bit more smart and skillful and develop some of these preliminary states of mind. Yeah?
When I was home from watching television, and there's something emotional coming up, I moved very easily.
Yeah.
The most ridiculous is, I mean, I know they're even nationalistic, there's some silly politician who's up there and sort of a very ruling speech can really sort of move me to tears. And reading things from watching things on television. But when I sit down, I would think of that would immediately transfer into a loving kindness, but when I sit down and try to do meditation, it was dry.
Yeah, okay, you're asking that sometimes when one sees something on the television, a speech or a moving documentary, or you read something in a book, that it can move you to tears and you can get this enormous emotional surge inside of you. But then when you sit down to meditate, it's hard to keep that emotion to do, say, loving kindness meditation. What one needs to do there is to be able to separate the resulting emotion from its cause. So that the resulting emotion is like, you know, how you feel inside and how that came about, the story behind it, the occasion which you saw on the movie which brought that about. Leave that aside. How the emotion came about, just drop and don't contemplate or think about it, but just take the resulting emotion. And then, as one sits in the meditation, dwells with that emotion and give it the name metta, loving kindness. And then it will really start to work. Because sometimes, instead of the resulting emotion, we start to think about, you know, the two people and what they did which gave rise to this emotion, or the story in the book, or the anecdote which you just heard. And the experience gets complicated. So the result is this feeling of emotional warmth, embracing, joy. Just take that away from its cause and just dwell upon that. It's like when we do loving kindness meditation, you know, you can use all sorts of techniques to bring about that experience of metta. You know the way I teach about imagining a little kitten or a little puppy dog or something. It doesn't matter what you imagine, because once you generate the feeling of loving kindness, then you take away the perception of a dog or a little kitten, and you put in its place the perception of the result of the loving kindness. Like the way the Buddha taught, it doesn't really matter if you make a fire out of twigs, out of paper, out of coal, or out of oil. Fire is fire. Once it's caused, then you don't really put attention on the cause, you put on the result. You warm yourself by it. Oh yes, great. Well, the Brahmaviharas is the reflection on loving kindness, on compassion for those who are suffering, for sympathetic joy for those, or other people who are happy. You know, if someone gets into a deep jhana and they achieve something, how would you feel? Would you feel, why them and not me? Or would you feel, great, isn't it marvelous that someone's got a beautiful experience? Feeling joy and happiness, wow, someone's got somewhere, isn't that marvelous? That's like sympathetic joy. Karuna is very reasonably easy to develop. The sympathetic joy is the interesting one to develop. If you can be happy at someone else's success, if you read that someone's won the lotto and you bought $100 worth of tickets and didn't, you know, the happiness of someone else, and that is a very, that is a happiness of a very advanced being. And then equanimity, yeah?
My brother, he quite spiritual. He lost a drink, he didn't go to the public and stuff on Friday. And there's a fellow that was in Crossroads and they go down there. When actually I think the fellow was trying to get out of his shit. And the way some of the ways I used about money and got a little bit different with him. So I went to the other week and one of his others.
The lotto. advanced beings can be happy about such another person getting something. And if anyone ever, sort of at the monastery, any of the monks ever gets a really good experience at the monastery, then you know the feeling goes around the monastery and everyone gets so much energy and joy. When things are happening, everyone feels it. And so that does become a good source of energy and joy. Especially, I mean, winning the lotto is kid stuff. But now gaining like a really nice jhana or gaining one of these enlightenment experiences, then when you hear someone else has gained this, you know, usually it brings up, wow, this is marvelous, great. And everyone, it lifts everyone else up. What? Sometimes amongst the monks, but it's a rule which was made by the Buddha that we're not supposed to tell about these things to anyone other than our monks. And usually it's only those, you know, the monks in that little grouping, because sometimes there was one, I think she was a Taiwanese nun. I think she's still alive somewhere. She said, if ever you get enlightened, never tell anyone. Otherwise, you'll spend the rest of your life having to prove it. Because if you say to someone else you're enlightened, they'll always be looking at you and testing you out. Yeah. Actually, that's I haven't mentioned that in this talk, but it is an interesting experience that not when you're entering a jhana, but as you're emerging from a jhana, the mind is always so strong. that if you want to do loving kindness meditation, then when you emerge from a jhana, you do loving kindness meditation, and it's just so powerful. And you know, just realize just all the loving kindness meditation you were doing before was just, you know, playing around. And you can imagine just how Buddha could, you know, have so much loving kindness. The mind is just so powerful and strong. You just develop the thought of compassion, you know, or loving kindness, and it just radiates. The difference between a little flashlight and a big lighthouse. And so if you can gain any of these deep meditations, play around afterwards, enjoy the effect. And just rouse one thought of loving kindness and you just carry on blissing out. And you know, that's when other beings and other people especially can feel the effect of loving kindness. It's really, really strong. So that's, if you gain a jhana, you remember that, then at the end of it, you know, just rouse one thought of loving kindness. You know what I mean?
Sharing
a merit, whatever you do, because the mind is so strong, whatever thought you bring up into the mind, you know, the mind will just go along with it without any resistance, and it will sustain itself on that thought, and it will just grow, it will balloon up to be an enormously strong experience. But that's later on in the past. At the moment I'm using loving kindness meditation to gain those states. But I would do that loving kindness meditation earlier on, just to bring joy in the mind, and then do the breath meditation as the main vehicle to gain states of deep stillness. But as you do the breath meditation, keep that emotional that emotional aspect of it going. Because if it's like a dry watching of the breath, and you don't allow the emotional happiness to emerge, then it won't be strong enough to go into a jhana. And you may know that the two of the main jhana factors for the first jhana is this thing we call piti sukha, which is, you know, the happy joy, which is an emotional feeling of great. You know, very often you may hear monks calling these the ecstasy states, the bliss states. The Buddha called them the... it's got the automatic reverse. They're called like the happy abidings here and now. And it's where the enlightened monks and nuns hang out, you know, in the jhanas. They're abidings. And as such, the major aspects of them which become manifest to you when you experience them is just bliss. And that's an emotional state. And for many people, that one is afraid of such a powerful emotion. And it's one of the reasons why fear comes up when one is about to enter a jhana. It's just too strong. And one is not confident of those emotional states. And it's one reason why doing a little bit of loving kindness meditation is becoming a little bit accustomed to emotions in the mind, the positive emotions, is very, very useful. Some people think that the ideal of an enlightened Buddhist monk or a nun is someone with absolutely no emotions whatsoever, completely cold like a stone. Whereas that it's one of the beautiful experiences of having been a monk in Thailand. You see these monks who are enlightened, and the most delightful people to be with. Incredibly warm. Some have got terrific senses of humour. Ajahn Mahabua is terrifically warm. I mean, as you talk about Ajahn Mahabua, he's got this reputation for being very strict and very stern. But when I stayed with him, only for a short time, that in the afternoon when it was time to sweep the paths, I took my broom and I was sweeping in a part of the monastery. No one else was around. And as usually happens with this monk, he just appears out of nowhere, just round the corner, coming opposite direction. And he gave me such a smile of loving kindness, and you know, just told me in the most gentlest of words, you know, don't sweep the leaves to the edge of the path, because then you make like a furrow in the middle. Sweep them all to the centre, and then when in the centre, pick them up and put them in the forest. And he said it in such a gentle and loving way that it's never been matched in my whole life. Not even Ajahn Chah could match that loving kindness which Ajahn Mahabua gave me just on that time. And it stayed with me all my life. And this was the monk who was supposed to be the fiercest, toughest. He was an ex-boxer. And some monks quake in his presence, literally. And, you know, I just remember him as, you know, as far as loving kindness was concerned, he was the number one of all the monks I've met in Thailand. And it was good to see that. And he was talking about his teacher, Ajahn Mun, who was also Ajahn Chah's teacher. And if you look at his photographs, there's only two photographs of him. He looked stern and dry and cold, Ajahn Mun. But if you talk with the monks who knew him and lived with him, he was among the most kindest, warmest, gentlest of beings you could ever imagine. If you're misbehaving, you know, you'd know straight away, he'd tell you off. But if you were trying, he would just give you everything, every support. One of his disciples once came to visit our monastery in Serpentine, and he took me aside and said, well, look, if you have any powerful meditations and you're a bit concerned about it, or you want to know exactly what's happening, you can knock on my door any time, day and night, even if it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, just knock and I'll be more than happy just to help you. And he said it with such a sincerity that he really didn't mind being woken up in the middle of the night if it was to help me in my meditation. And you know, that really meant something to me. That was like a monk who had just immense compassion. But if any monks, when I went to visit his monastery in Thailand, some monks came there and they asked to stay for, I think, 3 months. And he said, okay, but you know, you have to practice properly. After 2 weeks, they asked if they can just go down to Bangkok just to get some more things. He said, yeah, you can go back down to Bangkok. You can't come back again. He said, you're going to be here for 3 months. You have to be here for 3 months. If you want to leave, you leave forever. Very, very strict. If you were trying, he would help you. If you're wasting your time, he'd chuck you out. That's that, yes. Loving kindness is the first, sympathetic joy is the third, compassion is the second. Compassion is the feeling of sympathy for those who are suffering. And the fourth one is equanimity, which is interesting to notice. Equanimity is an emotion. Do you continually radiate loving kindness to a person? Will they benefit in some way? It really depends upon the strength of your mind. At the very least, you will benefit. And they will benefit to some amount, some degree. But if you've got a very strong mind and you radiate loving kindness towards someone, very often they just feel it straight away, even though they may be a long way away. And that's when, you know, you can really affect people. So that's why that sometimes this meditation retreat might seem like hard, that you've got to keep on batting away at the breath and trying to get these jhana states. But it's just making your mind strong. And it's hard work making the mind strong. But once you can do it, once you can make the mind strong, then it's, there's so many things you can do with it. It's just like learning how to play a piano. You've got to do this boring up and down with these keys. and you know, it doesn't really sound very good and it's boring and it's tiresome, but it makes the fingers nimble and it gets you familiar with where all the different notes are. And if you're very, very strong, you gain your strength by just doing these basic exercises, then eventually you can play whatever you like. And that's where it starts to get fun.
Through the counting exercise, I think, it's one in, one out, isn't it? Up to 10.
Up to 9. 9, and 1 to 8, and 1 to 7, 1 to 6, 1 to 5, 1 to 4, 1 to 3, 1 to 2, and 1.
It's 1 in, 1 out.
That's right, yes.
The count at the end of the inhalation at the end of the exercise.
When you count the 1s or the 2s, it really doesn't matter, as long as it's some time between the beginning of an in-breath and the end of an in-breath. Some time between the beginning of an out-breath and the end of the out-breath. It doesn't matter when. The reason why each number is repeated, the same for the in-breath as the out-breath, is that if one just says one for the first breath, whether it's an in-breath or an out-breath, it just gives too much space for the mind just to go wandering off in the next breath. So you may have the beginning of the in-breath, one, and then you've got the whole of the rest of the in-breath and the next out-breath to go and think of other things. And it gives just too much space for the mind to wander. The reason why it is a very good preliminary exercise, because you can still wander a little bit between having noted the in-breath, one, before the out-breath needs to be noted, one. But that's not much of a space. You can go thinking of other things, but you've got to be back in time to catch the next breath. Well, you can do 10 if you like, but I know that sometimes, you know what it's like, I've done that I start this and I found I'm 18, breathing out 18. Hang on. you've lost it.
So you do 3 rounds of that, back down to 1.
That's right, yeah.
So 1 to 9, 1 to 9, 1 to 9.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Breathing in 1, breathing out 1, up to 9. Then 1 to 8, 1 to 7, 1 to 6, 1 to 5, 1 to 4, 1 to 3. Breathing in 1, breathing out 1, breathing in 2, breathing out 2. And breathing in one, breathing out one. That's one cycle, yeah.
That's three times that cycle.
Cycle, yeah. That's only if it's perfect. Then you've got no doubts that you have done the cycle correctly. If there's any doubt, you're not sure, you've got to start from the beginning again. Well, that's it. I mean, if you cannot do that, you've got to persevere. And what it just develops. First of all, it shows you how much mindfulness you have and where you are in the development of meditation. And it doesn't matter if you're right at the very beginning, because everyone starts at the beginning. At least you know where you are. The religious path starts with honesty and clarity. So you're actually facing up to the state of your mind. And once you know that, then it gives you the incentive to put forth more effort. You know you need more mindfulness, and then when you can achieve that, it's very clear, you know you have got this first stage, that your mindfulness is sufficient, you're getting somewhere, and you know the mind is ready to go off into the second stage of getting full awareness of the breath. One of the difficulties with meditation is having a very clear and gradual method, which you know what to do, and also you can check whether you're achieving the goal or not. Yeah. Sometimes, yes, but if the breath is lost, then that's when sometimes you just you go off and you're not quite sure where you are, or you may go beyond 9.
Yeah. I find that my breath is getting so quiet. I don't know whether I'm breathing or not. I don't know, and this is still at an early stage for me where I'm still trying to develop concentration. I don't know whether I should deliberately stir up my breath or let it fade out, and what will happen if it fades out.
Yeah. Well, if it's at an early stage and the breath becomes very difficult to see, it might be worthwhile just stirring it up a bit. This is one of the advices of Ajahn Chah is, if you lose the breath, just stop breathing. Hold your breath, just for a few seconds, and then let it go again, and you find the breath is very evident after you've held it for a few seconds. Because usually what happens here, the breath hasn't stopped, it's just the breath has got a bit more refined and the mindfulness isn't sharp enough to follow it. It could also be that you're trying to watch the breath at a particular place in the body and it disappears from there. And that's why the advice I gave of just being aware of the breath wherever it manifests is much better than just watching it at one particular place. Am I breathing in or am I breathing out? Is the question I ask myself. And if the breath seems to disappear, then you ask yourself, am I breathing at all? And I know it's what the Buddha said, that there's only two occasions when you stop breathing, and that's one is when you're dead, and the other one is when you're in the fourth jhana. And I ask myself, am I in the fourth jhana? No. Am I dead? No. Therefore, I must be breathing. So the breath hasn't disappeared, it's just one is not noticing it. And then just ask yourself, am I breathing in or breathing out? And then there'll be some perception of breath somewhere there. Whatever that perception is, then just use that. Yeah? That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. Do the three cycles of the counting. If this is just a means of telling you that you have enough mindfulness and stillness that you've got this, like stage one. Yeah. No, I don't do that with sit down. Because that system was just with one breath, counting up to nine, and then with one breath, 9 to 1. That's an excellent system, because you know, I told you that I used to do that, the first meditation method which I learned. Again, that actually, if you've done that, that's a very good technique for the second stage, the full awareness of the breath. Maybe I just mentioned that as it's been brought up. If you've got the first stage of the meditation, so each in-breath, out-breath, you know, then you might actually do a counting of nine just inside one in-breath. The beginning of the in-breath, one. You count 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Until it's the end of the in-breath. And then the out-breath, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Not necessarily. Sometimes the breaths are very slow when you're relaxed. Sometimes if it's a shorter breath, you can just do it to 6 or to 3. But what that does, it just gives you a bit more hope of following the whole breath. Because you have to note 9 times in between the beginning of an in-breath and the end of an in-breath.
Then.
Well, you just go up to 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever it is, just to see how long the breath is. But very often, when you're relaxed and you're meditating, very often the breath is very smooth and very slow, because the body doesn't need much oxygen. So it's very often at 9 is plenty of time.
That's
one problem with
the cycle of three, isn't it? Not, it might take a long
time to go through that cycle. Okay. Time.
I want to get up and walk.
Yeah, no,
it's only... I want to go to the second stage.
With that cycle, it's 45 breaths is one cycle. So 3 cycles is 135 breaths. Which isn't that long. Maybe about 5, 10 minutes or something.
I think the music talks about the sound of silence.
Yeah. Well, the sound of silence can be used as a preliminary exercise to enter samadhi, but its difficulty is that if you are meditating on the sound of silence, you are getting too close to other sounds as well. And because, you know, you're listening for a sound, and the other sound, such as a plane overhead or a dog barking, will come straight into the mind as well. So it can be a start to the meditation, but once it's settled you down reasonably well, then let go of that and go on to something like the breath. It won't take you deep enough into meditation. It's a very useful and very skillful preliminary exercise. Listen to the sound of silence. It can be done many ways, from closing your eyes and just listening to, realizing that the sense of sound is still occurring, even though it's silent, and gaining experience of even like a ringing or a humming, which is there all the time, but we don't really notice it because of other sounds are there. And it, you know, becomes something I can just turn towards and stay with for a short while. And it's something more stable than the other sounds which we hear. So it gives you a sense of peacefulness and relaxation. Now, with all the different teachings, you find as many skillful means which people develop, and every monk will always develop their own special skillful means. You know, some of the things which I teach, no one else will teach, and I don't teach many things which other people teach. And it will always be that way, that everyone will develop their own skillful means, their own little techniques. The important thing is always to stress the core techniques and the meanings behind these techniques, so that any students can take these techniques and be able to realize these are just techniques, nothing more, but they know why they are used, where they're leading towards. And as you meditate and you gain results, there's little things which work for you and things which you didn't hear but which you make up yourself, which will work, and there'll be your techniques which you will teach later on. So if it works, use it, but not everything which works for me will work for you. That's right, it may not appeal to you if it's a technique, and it may be fine, it may be a very powerful and good technique, but because for some reason it doesn't appeal to you, it doesn't work for you, then you don't use it and don't teach it. But at least you should understand the heart, the thread going through all techniques, which is to settle the mind down, to bring that joy, that mindfulness, and that those beautiful states of mind into being. And this gradual calming of the mind, the gradual collecting of the attention onto one chosen object, and to developing the happiness, the joy of that stability into an emotional state which will take you into deep meditation states, to empower the mind. Okay, I think that's enough for now.